So verse 11 of John 20. But Mary stood outside by the tomb weeping, and as she wept, she stooped down and looked into the tomb. And she saw two angels in white sitting, one at the head and the other at the feet, where the body of Jesus had lain. Then they said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "Because they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." Now, when she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there and did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" She, supposing him to be the gardener, said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned and said to him, "Rabboni," which is to say, teacher. Jesus said to her, "Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father. But go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, and to my God and your God." Mary Magdalene came and told the disciples that she had seen the Lord and that he had spoken these things to her.
There is a story from Russia during or shortly after the Communist Revolution. And this orator is telling everybody there is no God. And if you believe in God, you're actually kind of not quite there. And Jesus isn't real. He hasn't risen from the dead. And then he asks the Orthodox priest to respond. The priest stands up and he says these words, "Christ is risen." And what did the people say?
He is risen indeed.
And the argument was over. Today we celebrate Easter. And I want us to go back many years and to go to the tomb and see what happens there. I want to particularly pay attention to John. However, in order to do this and in order to understand this story, we need to see it through John's eyes, the writer of the Gospel of John. And you may ask me, why should we do that? And I think it's just so important because we need to understand their worldview and the points that he is trying to make. There are three things that we need to understand somebody's worldview. We have these things too, but we may not recognize them because we live in them. So in John's world, there are three things that are critically important. The first one is stories. What stories would John have told? What stories would have influenced his life and given meaning to the Jews at that time? There would be the story of creation. There would be the story of the garden. There would be the story of the deliverance at Passover from Egypt. There would be this long history that they could look back at and say, this gives us meaning. This is who we are. Now, John is a storyteller, and when Jesus comes, he has to rethink those stories in light of Jesus' resurrection. John is interesting. He tells these stories different than the other gospel writers. They all tell the story of Jesus, and Mark, Matthew, and Luke are quite similar. They all have their own nuances, and they tell it from their own point of view. But John is much different yet, and he tells this story from a very different perspective. When we understand those stories and go back and look at them, it helps us to understand what they're interested in. They're not interested in our scientific questions. They're not interested in evolution. They're not interested in any of those questions that we want to. Scientific questions like how big is our universe? How old is it? They're not worried about that. What they're concerned about is who created it. Who is the creator? And who are they in relationship to it? That's their concern. So when he looks at his stories, he needs to reimagine them in light of Jesus' resurrection. So that's the one thing we need to understand, is the stories that influence their lives. It's a little bit like the story of the priest in Russia. He knew his stories, and when he said, "Christ is risen," and everybody responded, it was the complete argument that he needed to make to the sophisticated orator who said there was no God. We also need to understand something about the symbols of that world. At John's time, the big symbol would have been the temple. It said everything that there is to say about the Jewish faith. It said there's the place where God should come and rule the world from. It was the place central to all of things that happened in Israel, the land of Palestine at that time. The Jewish temple is the symbol, would be like what we saw happen with the Cathedral of Notre Dame. It burns, and in 24 hours, all the money is raised to rebuild it. It's that important. You bring the wrong person into the temple, you are in very big, big trouble. You do the wrong thing in there, you're in trouble. That's one of the reasons why Jesus is executed, is because came into the temple and he overturned the tables and he upset the system, and it was a no-no. He had to go after that. We have our symbols as well. In the Christian faith, there would be the symbol of the cross. You burn it, we will all be up in arms, because it has a very significant message to us. The third thing that we need to understand from the Jewish world in John's time is practice. What did they do that brought meaning to life? What do we do that brings meaning to life? So you take some of those symbols and then you put them into practice. So for John, the big practice was Passover. It's when you came to Jerusalem, if you could, you offered a sacrifice, and that sacrifice said, "God brought us freedom in the past." It remembers Egypt. It remembers coming back from exile. But it does more than that. It looks forward to a new release from slavery. It looks forward to God bringing freedom again. So it looks back and it looks forward. So when you practice Passover, you ate that meal, you spent that week in Jerusalem, you were making a huge statement about what your whole belief system was. So if you think of Jesus' story of riding into Jerusalem on the first day of the week of the Passover, on a donkey, in an occupied city, he's making a huge statement on Passover that everybody looked for to the future, to say, will this person bring us the freedom that we are looking for? So John is highly uses these symbols to give us this message of Jesus. So I know this is a lot of information to kind of think, to get this story of the resurrection into it, but we need to work at it. It will help us to understand what's going through Mary Magdalene's mind when she goes to the tomb on the first day of the week, very, very early in the morning when it is still dark. Remember what Heather read for us, because we saw in John chapter 1, there is Jesus is being declared, being equal with God. He is the creator. Nothing is created without him. He is the light of the world. John wants us to draw us right back into creation and start from there and tell the story as we know it. So when we look at the creation story in Genesis and in chapter 1, and then we find that the story starts with the creation of light. And in John chapter 1, John is telling us that Jesus is actually the light of the world. He is making a very direct reference back to the creation story. Light is created on the first day. It comes out of darkness. It's a separation. So you have night and you have day on day one. And then on day four, you go back and you start this story again and God creates light again. And I know we like to say, oh, that's the sun and the moon. And it talks about a greater or a lesser light. However, if you were to look at the Hebrew a little bit and you would look at the word light, it is only ever used for the lamp in the temple. It is never used for the light of the sun or the moon. That is a different word totally. You are in a story that is telling you something else. It is telling you to think of the temple of God's rule on this earth. And then you think of this the way John tells his story. He has Jesus going to the temple more than any of the other gospel writers. And when Jesus is in the temple, and he cries out, I am the light of the world, and you understand what is in the temple, and there is a lamp with the seven candlesticks representing God's light to the world, the light that Genesis 1 talks about on the fourth day of creation. And you say, Jesus is saying, that is me. Whatever that light represents, that's who I am. So we should ask ourselves, what happens to that light when Jesus dies? What did Mary Magdalene think of after Jesus' death? What did the other apostles think about of Jesus' death? You see, in John, Jesus dies at the time when the Passover lamb is being slaughtered, being sacrificed. You see, their hopes were that Jesus, when he rode into Jerusalem and everybody had laid the coats in front of his donkey and had cried out, Hosanna, Son of David, save us, is what it says. Save us now, King of David, or Son of David, in David's line. Their hopes were that Jesus would actually do that. It had just been way it's written. You would think that this was King Solomon coming back as the Son of David, riding into Jerusalem. There is all this rejoicing when King Solomon rode in as a king for the first time. The rocks cry out. There's an earthquake. Remember Jesus saying, if the kids don't cry out, the rocks will? Well, it's a reference back to when Solomon became king. These people are hoping for a new king. But the expectation all ended a week later. And it seemed that fate had played a very cruel joke on everybody else. Jesus is executed and he's laid in a tomb, and it's the Sabbath, so the day before the Sabbath, so they keep the Sabbath. Sabbath speaks of freedom, delivery, all of those things, but they couldn't go there because you couldn't work. It was too far to go away. So Monday morning, our Monday morning, their Sunday morning rolls around, the first day of the new week. Mary goes to the tomb. I want us to come with her and let's see what happens there. You see, Mary knew these stories. She knew the story of the Garden of Eden. When that first couple had been right there in God's very presence, were able to commune with him, to talk with him, to say, how's it going? What's life like? But that garden had become a place of death. They'd eaten the fruit that they said God had said, no, don't eat it. And that had resulted in death and expulsion from that garden. And the way back is guarded by some cherubim. And these represent God's rule over the whole world. And Ellen, could you show me the slide here? Just so we know what a cherubim is, they're not angels. They're a composite creature. These two here that you see up there are actually came out of a palace in Nineveh from the Assyrians. They have the head of a human. They have the wings of an eagle. And then these ones have the body of an ox and the feet of a lion. So they're represented of all of creation. Humans, the human there would be the king, represents the head of all of God's creation. You have the wings is of the eagle, which is the king of the birds. The oxen or the bull is the strongest animal that humans could tame, so it is the king of the beasts. And the lion, of course, is the king of the wild beasts. It represents all of creation. And this is what guarded Eden. It says there's God's Eden is God's throne. And so if you were to go to the temple at the time of Jesus and you were to enter in it, you would have seen the cherubim on the curtain that was torn in two. And they're always in twos. And you would have seen the cherubim all over on the walls, recognizing that God's total creation. The cherubim are also on the Ark of the Covenant. The cherubim the wings could be together and they would make a throne out of that where the king would sit on. So it represents God's rule over all of creation. The garden that had been full of promise was now guarded not by angels but by cherubim. Mary knew that. But she also knew that there was a promise of a way back to that position. There was the promised land where God would dwell with his people and he would have this place where you could actually come and you could say, there's God in that temple. The tabernacle and the temple represented God's rule over all the world. That is from where God would someday rule the world. That is what they understood. So when Jesus had ridden into Jerusalem and then had gone to the temple and cleaned it out, he had done what every Oriental king at that time would do when he came to a city. He would ride into the city and he would go to the place of worship. And he would worship at the main temple. It is what Jesus had done. He had ridden into the city as a king. Expectations were high. That temple, remember, is where the cherubim are. That's where the lamp is. That's where everything said that God would rule from. When Jesus entered there, he is saying, I actually am the person. This is my Father's house, is what he says. He is saying, this is where I should be. However, when you read the Gospel of John, Jesus is being replacing the temple. He is saying, I'm the light of the world. The candlestick is not important. It's me. When the priests are having a ceremony and pouring out water, Jesus will cry, I am the living water. No one who comes to me will be thirsty. Jesus is saying, look at me, not at what the temple, not at the symbol. Look at the real thing. Mary would have known all of those stories. That would have been her expectation that Jesus would fulfill them. However, there was the execution of Jesus. And now it is the first day of the week, the day after Passover, and Mary is on her way to the tomb. Passover is always celebrated according to the moon. So it has been full moon. The moon is set. The sun is not up. And John is very careful to tell us it's a new day, but it's dark. It's very dark in the morning. Mary cannot see well. It is the darkest time of the day. It is the darkest time in Mary's life. Mary's world had turned to the chaos and the darkness that you read about in Genesis 1, verse 1 and 2. Her world has undone itself. What hope is there for that kind of a world that has all of a sudden become empty and dark? When we get to the tomb with Mary, we see that the stone has been rolled away. We can see it in the dark. And there is no one inside. What is going through Mary's mind? Did someone take that body? And why? If they did. Jesus had been buried. Remember, he'd been naked on the cross. He had nothing of value with him that anybody would want. Like, why would you rob his tomb? And besides, it had been guarded by soldiers. We now see Mary running to go and tell the other apostles. And we see them come racing back and go in and look and leave. All they saw was the cloth that Jesus' body had been wrapped in. The apostles were of no help to Mary. What will Mary do? She stays there. She doesn't understand what has happened. So what is she to do? She had so much hope in this man. He had meant so much for her. He had done so much for her. There seemed to be nothing to do but weep. She cries for the broken dreams she has. I think she cries for all humanity. Because everything has gone horribly wrong this week. Her friend, the one that they had all hoped in, had died, executed under Roman hands in the most cruel way you could do that. What hope can you have? Well, your hope had been that God would come to his people. And now look at this. Your hope had been that the garden scene in Genesis chapter 2 would be restored and you could once more talk to God personally, face to face, or with his representative. But we know the story of that first garden. Somebody had eaten the fruit and you couldn't go there. That garden had turned into a tomb. But wait, it's still very early in the morning. It's still dark, but light is starting to come. And people are stirring and going back to work. This is the first day of the week, and you must now go back to work. The Sabbath is over, that day of rest when you remembered you were a slave and God had freed you. You remembered God's creation and all that he had done, and that there could be rest. And it is also the day that the people remembered that God had entered his rest. That is the first day of the week falls right after that Sabbath. As the day lightens, Mary looks around her, and she sees two angels in this tomb. They are not cherubim. They are not guards. They are angels, messengers. And they say, "Mary, why are you crying?" And Mary's response is, "I'm looking for my master. I'm looking for my friend. Where have they put him?" How can I say goodbye to a friend when he's not there? But Mary does not give up her search. Mary lifts her eyes and looks around her. And she sees there is somebody standing beside her. And she thinks, he's the gardener. So I went in the greenhouse and I asked Lucy and Petra. I said, why did Mary think Jesus was the gardener? And I think Petra gave the best answer I've heard. She said, he's got his watering can, it's early in the morning, and he's watering his plants. I think that is the picture we need to have, because Jesus is doing something, we're not told, but he's doing something that makes Mary think that he's a gardener. Do you realize what has just happened with that statement? The tomb, the grave site, the graveyard, has turned into a garden. Where have we been in a garden before? John is a very interesting. When Jesus goes out to pray in the night, all the other gospels will say that he goes to an olive grove. But when they come out of that, when Jesus is arrested and the person asks Peter later, well, says, you were with Jesus and you were in the garden. John has two gardens. He has the garden of betrayal in his gospel, and he has a garden that is the answer to that betrayal. He has a garden that is actually the answer to the Garden of Eden. That gardener asks Mary, why are you crying, and who are you looking for? And we hear Mary reply, sir, or master, if you've taken his body, tell me where it is, because I want to go find it. I want to say goodbye. I want to give him a proper burial. And we hear the gardener say, Mary. And we see a complete change in what has happened. Everything has changed. It is like the first day of the first week. Everything starts to make sense. It is new. There is light. If death does not have the last say, then what happened in the Garden of Eden does not have the last say. That door is not closed. Those cherubim are gone. The close relationship that first couple had in the garden can be restored. This is not the end. It is the beginning. Think about it a little bit. Think of that story in Genesis chapter 2 and 3 and what's all happened there, and it dashes all the hope for humanity. Became the place of death. Ate this fruit and you will die. Now we are in a garden that we thought contained death, but now it contains life. Death has lost its control. And the cherubim are gone. Let's go back to that other slide, please. There's no need to go to the temple. You see, John does not record the tearing of the curtain, because Jesus has replaced that temple. That temple is nothing after Jesus cleanses it, because it only pointed to Jesus. It only pointed to God. And there is no need to point when the real thing is there. However, it still represented God's throne. However, when you think of Good Friday, when that curtain tore, you could look inside into the Holy of Holies, where the throne room were, where God's footstool was, and it's empty. But if you looked on the further outside the city, there is another throne, and on it says the King of the Jews, the ruler of the universe, was in a different place. God was not off in some far distant place and had to come back to his own people. He was there. He was there to be touched and to be held. When Jesus says, Mary, she turns around, and the scene that I have in her mind is she gives him this big bear hug. It is what I would do if I saw a friend who I thought I would never see again, and he had meant everything to me. Yes, Jesus says, I need to go back to my Father and your Father, my God and your God. You can't hang on to me, but I will continue this presence with you by the Holy Spirit. Because of that event, there is a great reversal. I don't know if I like the term reversal. Maybe a movement forward, a turning of right side up, of a world that has been upside down that has now become right. Think of Mary Magdalene. She is now given the task of going to the apostles and telling them the gospel. She has become the first preacher of the good news. She has become the apostle to the apostles. She is to bring the good news that Jesus really is who you were looking for. No, that's not true. They were looking for somebody to rescue them from their physical situation only. Jesus is not only the gardener, he is the creator. He is there with them. Mary has been given the highest role from all of them. So what is Mary going to tell all of these men? These men who fled at the execution and then went home from the empty tomb without looking further for Jesus. They had fled. They were scared. Remember the scene in the first garden? The man and woman eat the fruit, and what do? They go and hide. What are these people doing, these men? They are hiding. They are full of fear. She could bring the good news and say, hey, Jesus is the guy you're looking for, but I think she would go and say, you know what? We had it wrong. He is way more than what we are looking for. Way more than what we were expecting. Here is the Creator himself who is taking darkness and turning it into life. And we can hug him. We can hold him. We can touch him. He is more than what we were expecting. So we need to ask ourselves, what has John done with these stories? He has reimagined his symbol of the temple, and he has come up with Jesus. He has reimagined the story of creation and the story in the garden and said, there is a new garden where life comes, and death does not have the last say. He is saying, there is a story of creation, and it's me, Jesus, that has done it. And I am the light that it points to. So John, under the Holy Spirit, reimagines his story. He reimagines the story of Passover and says, that Passover back there in Moses' day, remember that? That's nothing. Did you see the Passover that Jesus just brought us? No longer do you need to go to the temple to worship, because what it points to is here. It means that you can have a day of hope that someday God will finish what he has started, that this creation actually is moving towards something. Death will not have the last say. Sorrow will not have the last say. It means that we as a people need to go back and do what John did. How can we reimagine our stories in light of the resurrection? If we cannot imagine them, how would we work for it? I think God has given us imaginations that we need to use to see the future in a way that God would want us to see, and then work towards that. We need to look at what brings meaning to our lives and then see what new meaning Jesus' resurrection can give them. You see, Jesus' resurrection turns everything right side up. What difference does the resurrection make to our church? How can we reimagine our role within our community as God's representatives, of bringing meaning to our community in a new way? How can we reimagine our life that we live every day when we go to work, wash the dishes or cook or whatever we do, raise our kids? How can we reimagine our lives with wisdom and compassion instead of rules and fears? How can we reimagine our political system in our countries where the ultra-right gains power, and it is power that they worship? How can we reimagine that there could be a different way of living that would align with what John is saying, would align with Jesus' message, where the poor and the needy have first place, where those outside of the normal role in society have the first place? Mary should not have been at the garden. Mary should not be the witness in that society to Jesus' resurrection. It should have been the men. But Jesus has turned that upside right. Mary was the first person there. And she was the one that he gave the message to say, go tell everybody else. So how do we reimagine their future in light of Jesus' resurrection? Christ is risen. Christ is risen.
He is risen indeed.
Christ is risen.
He is risen indeed.